Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming. In the past year or so, there have been a number of situations where the biodynamic work has been maligned in publications. And people have been put in very compromising positions with regard to whether or not biodynamics is pseudoscience or not. And it probably is not unique to the present situation. I'm sure during the time of Rudolf Steiner, there were similar accusations that the work in biodynamics was pseudoscience, the work in anthroposophical medicine was pseudoscience. And what I'd like to do today is give you some pictures that can help help a person understand what is similar in biodynamics to contemporary scientific point of view and what is different. There are similarities and there are differences. And it's my experience that it's very helpful to kind of cut the stuff that's useful and the stuff that's not useful to kind of find a line there. So what I want to do today is to show you, or to try to at least start a dialogue about where that line is. And the overarching idea that I would like to present to you is that there really isn't a difference between the way in which modern science operates and the way biodynamics works, except for the relationship of the language. It's a languaging thing. And if we could find the right language, it's possible to make bridges to people who are doing work in science that are not quite so locked in abstraction, but are searching for a way in regular scientific circles to express things that they're finding that they can't explain. And I think if we were able to do that in biodynamics, we'd find allies in the scientific community who would be willing to extend or to withhold judgment. And if we find the right language, then the language allows for a bridging. So I would like to give you just a picture of this, because my message, I guess, today is that it's a pictorial language. The alchemical language is a language of pictures. And in reality, in science, there are also pictures. But through abstraction, we've lost a sense of what the pictures mean. So I'll give you an example. We know in agriculture that we have fertilizer is NPK. N is nitrogen, P is phosphorus, and K is potassium. But we could ask, why is K potassium? Well, K stands for Kali, K-A-L-I. Mother Kali. Because in Sanskrit, Kali means the black one. And the black one is the one who was destroyed and rises from the black ashes. It is the destroyer and the one who revives. That's a picture. It's a picture of what we could call a being that now we call potassium. But in the old world, potash was a substance that was pot ash. It was, the grapevines were burnt in a big pot. And the ash was slaked in order to get the alkaline solution to solidify the pig fat to make the soap. People made soap by burning things, and the salt that came out of the ash was the agent that emulsified the fat to make it into soap. It was pot ash. The salt revives out of the burning process. If you burn a plant and you put the ashes in water, what goes into the water is the salt that attracted the water to help the plant grow. That's potassium. So potassium in a plant is an activity, but in the ancient world there were pictures of that activity that connected it to a kind of beinghood. It was a pictorial language that allowed the people who worked with these substances to understand that they were not just dead, inert things. They were actually living, intelligent activities. They were intelligent. They had a consciousness. Potassium had a consciousness. And the consciousness was, when things got destroyed, hidden in them was this secret being who could resurrect again. That's a pictorial consciousness, because it shows you not just the substance, but the dynamic of the substance, the activity of the substance. And it's my understanding that that pictorial language, the alchemical language, is the reason why it's biodynamics. The dynamics are the activity of the substance. And Rudolf Steiner's language, as an incredible alchemical genius, I could say, is to see into the beings of nature and resurrect them from the grave of abstraction. But it doesn't mean that his pictures are random or fantastical. They're just pictorial. And there's an inner logic to the pictorial language that if we can work with it in a precise way, can build a bridge to a chemist who would understand that we understand potassium, but they might be intrigued to find out that it has something to do with Mother Kali. You never know. You just never know. This person may be looking for something like that because they're in a lifetime of being in a laboratory, they've seen things they can't explain just through molecular attraction. Yeah, and I think for me, and especially in an event like this when so many people show up, it says to me that there's an interest in moving things in that direction. There's an interest in taking this ancient kind of language that we would find in alchemy and moving it in a precise way, the way Rudolf Steiner did, to link up certain phenomena, so that when we describe them, we're not describing them in a fantastical way, but in a way that is exact and yet imaginative. The exact imaginative language allows a person to see the relationship between the organ of an animal, the organ of a plant, the activity of a mineral in the soil, and the relationship of all those things to planetary patterns. In regular science, those are completely different realms. I have people, when I used to do a lot of work on dark weather, I haven't put so much stuff up recently, but when I did that in the past, I would have people regularly email me telling me, could I please stop connecting planets to weather? Makes them nervous. If I want to talk about weather, talk about weather. Apparently you know something about weather, so could you please just talk about weather? But I find what you say interesting about weather, but this planet stuff, can you, you know? And I usually would write back, gee, why don't you get your own website? You can say whatever you want on your own website. Okay, so when we switch languages, or when we find a language, it's possible to link these great large things to the small things. But we have to be very careful when we use the pictorial language that we use it in a precise way, because it is very precise. But it's precise in the way a poem is precise, not in the way a formula is precise. And so we have to have a different kind of consciousness. We can't just make things up. But they have to be living. So what I'd like to attempt to do today, I've been thinking about this for a long, long time. And when I was invited to do this again this year, I decided this was going to be my little gesture here to try to say, I think that the fundamentals of the work in biodynamics are these polarities. So on the board here, you see I'll just keep this board the way it is. These are, after working with this for a long time, I recognized that the dynamic part of biodynamics comes as a result of these, of what Goethe called polarity and enhancement. That in the natural world, there are fundamental polarities. And in those fundamental polarities, it's possible to see a kind of tension. And the tension, it gets resolved when the polarities become extreme. There is a natural tendency for the polarity to become so extreme that the system flips to the opposite side. And when the system flips to the opposite side, that's where the dynamic comes from. And the degree of extremity of the tension creates the degree of the dynamic. The greater the insulation, the greater the discharge. The weaker the insulation, then you're always getting small short circuits. So this is a kind of fundamental rule of the natural world. And if you understand this, then in Rudolf Steiner's indications about the preps and about the organs of the preps and the particular substances, you can begin to see that there is a very deep and fundamental polarity. Okay, so the most fundamental polarity is that there is a center and a periphery. Rudolf Steiner in the agriculture course calls this ABC XYZ of plant growth. The alpha and the omega. And in all living systems, there's a tension between the activity of the center and the activity of the periphery. If it's a cell, you have the cytoplasm and the cell membrane. If it's a weather system, you have the center of the low and the jet stream that's running along the edge. So all in all life, there is a tension between the center and the periphery. Rudolf Steiner characterizes the forces of the center, calls them centric. He says these are the earthly forces. The earthly forces establish a center and then slowly move out from the center to dominate the space around the center. That's the action of the centric forces. You get a spore. The spore germinates, sends out mycelia, and dominates the area around it. And continues to do that until you have a fairy ring. That is a typical, what we could call an earthly gesture. The peripheral gesture, the cosmic gesture, comes from the periphery and begins to interact with what's moving out from the center. And in nature, the phenomena of the periphery are the ones that are difficult to explain through chemistry and molecular attraction. They are the forces of the environment that change the pH of something, or that change the potential for something, or they are the interface where the prey and the predator meet. So the peripheral forces in nature are the ones that are difficult to meter. The centric forces are much easier to meter and to gauge because they are in the center dominating space. So we have measurements for them. We can measure them. But when we have forces that are very weak, and they are what we could call the strong forces. They are the explosive forces. We know how to blow things up. Our whole technology is based on blowing things up. I'm going to put my hat on here. It's kind of cool. So the blowing things up is the centric. I put something in the middle, I blow it up, and it dominates the space around it. But how things get organized from the periphery is very difficult to gauge. And Rudolf Steiner said that's because the forces from the periphery are weak forces, but very consistent. The forces from the center are strong forces, but are weakened very rapidly, exponentially, from the center. So if I have forces from the center moving out, the square of the distance from the center, they're weakened by exponents as we go out. But the weak forces from the periphery are enhanced as they move in. That's the hard part, but they're weak. Cosmic rays and stuff like that, they're weak. But over time and through repetition, they begin to show up. And this is exactly the problem with trying to monitor the effects of biodynamics, is because they are not statistically robust, but they are statistically consistent. Meaning, there's something there. But we can't measure it because they're not robust, because all our instruments and way of measuring and evaluating things are used to things. We measure things that are moving from a center and weakening exponentially. Yeah? So in today's science, the forces from the periphery are always the mysterious ones. But in biology, in embryology, the center is reacting to these parts per million of the solutions that they're in. The cellular tissues are reacting to parts per million. Very weak forces from the periphery, but they react. And over time, that reaction has a cascade of enzymes, for instance, and then you get a measurable reaction. Parts per million. 50 years ago, it was impossible to measure parts per million. We didn't have the sophistication, but we do now. 5 parts per million, the activity of phosphorus in the development of an enzyme cascade. Hello, 5 parts per million. Cosmic. Peripheral. Weak, but consistent. Okay, that's what I mean. I think the time is ripe where the language of science and the way in which science can analyze can meet these forces of the periphery, these weak forces, and find a bridging, but it has to do with languaging. Okay, so the most fundamental is that we have a periphery where we have very weak but consistent forces, and a center where we have very strong but very rapidly diminishing forces. I could say that, to me, that's what I'm sharing with you, is a very fundamental meditation. So in the natural world, try to find the interface where is the periphery acting on this thing in the center. Try to form imaginations of that. And that will be then the beginning of a pictorial consciousness that will allow you as a worker on the land to speak to somebody who's a specialist. Because maybe in their centric consciousness, they've noticed this interaction with stuff at the periphery, but they don't have a way to really bring it into focus yet. Yeah, that's my thesis, so to speak, for the day. Okay, so that's the most fundamental: center, periphery, earth as center, and cosmos. Now, in the in the list there, I just made a list of things that you can think of along those lines. So we have the center in the terms of planetary activity would be the inner planets, Mercury, Venus, and Mars. Well, Mars is sort of an outer planet. Mercury and Venus and the Moon. Mercury, Venus, and Moon, inner planets, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, outer planets. So in the agriculture course, Rudolf Steiner separates those two planetary groups and connects the inner planets to the activity of calcium and potassium, the earth alkalis. Inner, they have a tendency to precipitate out. They have a tendency to be to form things. Calcium and potash form substances. And the outer planets is more silica. And silica has a tendency to be dispersed, the way Rudolf Steiner describes it. He said it's silica in the atmosphere. Well, that's a tough one for science, but it could be called silicic acid, the oxide of silica, which is measurable. Okay, atmospherically, atmospheric silica, air silica. And that silicious gesture is permeating the way in which plants interact with solar forces and whatever. It's a kind of light nutrition. And it has to do with the way the pigments in plants take up the light and stimulate enzyme activity. Things like that, that can be measured. Okay, we could call it silica, cosmic silica or attenuated silica. Okay, so in the plant, that calcium gesture is very much connected to the way in which the root forms. And in the plant, the silica gesture is the opposite, is very much the way in which the flowering leads to a seed process. Why? Because that activity is on the periphery of the plant. Whereas the root forming its first radical, thank you, the radical coming out of the seed is a kind of calcium salt, an incarnating gesture from my center. And now I'm spreading out to the periphery from my center. I'm dominating space. So the radical coming out from a root is a gesture of the centric activity, but the plant going into flower is a gesture of the silica activity, the peripheral activity. You'll find silica gets enhanced towards the flowering pole, sort of shows up in the flowering pole. And then finally, in the animal realm, the metabolism is the place in the animal where the centric forces dominate through the activity of calcium and alkaline secretions of digestion. Whereas in the nerves and in the sense activity, that's dominated by silica. So our digestive organs are in the center and our sense organs are on the periphery. Digestive organs have to do with blood and the alkaline destruction of things, and the sense organs have to do with sheaths of silica in the eardrum and the eye and nerves and sensory activity on the periphery of the organism. It's a sense activity in the embryo that comes from the periphery that causes the forces of the embryo to kind of manifest. This goes into even the forming of the brain. Sense activity drives the nerves in, and then the response of the tissues is to build in that patterns of the sense activity. This is just from regular embryology. And then if you read about it, they'll say, well, it's kind of mysterious, but it looks like, you know, forces from the edge of this particular organ, the organ grows because of the environment that it's in. That's peripheral force. And then they'll say, well, we have no idea why this happens, but this is the way it is. Okay, that's because in the abstract language, the language of the periphery is not available. It's mysterious. It's recognized, but there's no way to explain it because it's not coming from the center out. It just sort of shows up somehow. But it's recognized that that's the way it is. What they'll say is, oh, well, when this organ touches that organ, there's a chemical exchange, and that's what creates it. Yeah, but the big picture of why that organ is touching that organ, well, that's you, if you want to answer that, you need to go to the theology department. Not this is biochemistry. Okay, but I think there is a possibility to build a bridge. Okay, so that those polarities, I just put them up there as a kind of background for the work. I'll be referring to various ways of looking at them throughout the day. So please look on your, there are handouts. up on the board here, I've put an outline of what's up here in this corner, in the upper right-hand corner. And what I'd like to do is use these ideas of polarities to take a look at the relationship between the minerals in the biodynamic preparations, the plant gesture in the biodynamic preparations, the animal gesture in the prep, and then give a picture of how the cosmos interacts with these things, just through planetary loops. People I know came in and went, oh my God, information. So more information. But it's not so much the information, it's the pictures. It's the pictures. I'm going to try to speak a pictorial language. Just let the information flow through. We're recording these. If you want the information, then there'll be a CD of MP3s available if you want the information. But my work is not so much about giving information, but about trying to show you how the pictures work. Because NPK is a picture of something. It's not just stuff. It's a picture of a dynamic. So NPK is what is known as macronutrients. They're primary nutrients, micronutrients in a plant. And we could say that they are just nitrogen is a substance, and potassium is a substance. But earlier I gave a picture that maybe at one time it was a being that has now become a substance. If it was a being, how would it move? What would its life be? And when we put a substance into the natural world, we take something out of the natural world, we refine it or we concentrate it, then we put it back in the natural world. It's not without implications. We know that now. We take carbon out of things and then we put it back in the world in a different form and we call it global warming. So carbon is not just stuff, it has a consciousness. And the consciousness is telling us about our activity as humans now, saying, you need to pay attention to me as a being, because I'm trying to teach you something about the way you live your lives. So these polarities of the center and the periphery are active in these substances that we use. So I'll give you a very quick example, for instance, in the oak bark preparation. Up in the upper left, you'll see a little diagram of the oak bark. And the inner circle there, it says C-K-N-A-L-A-L-S-I. C is carbon, calcium, K, potassium, Na, sodium, aluminum, silica. That's just a mandala of substances that exist in the natural realm, in organic chemistry. And the little triangle there is the way in which Rudolf Steiner has linked the particular substances that he says, oh, take oak bark and put it in a skull. The triangle is, if you were to go and look at what oak bark is, you would see that oak bark has very strong radiations of calcium. That's down there at about 7, 8 o'clock. Silica at 12 o'clock. And phosphorus at 2:30. That's the triangle. So in oak bark, by analysis, we have a very strong calcium radiation, a silica radiation, and a phosphorus radiation. So that's just chemistry. But we could say, what is that a picture of? Well, it's a picture of an activity where we have calcium, which is on a centric force, and phosphorus, which is phosphor means the bearer of light. Phos, light, for, or fair, from phira, to carry. Phosphorus is a substance that carries light. Used to be a god. It was called Lucifer. 100 years ago, if you bought a pack of matches, they were called Lucifers. Oh, give me a Lucifer. A light bearer. So phosphorus is a light bearer. Calcium is an earthly substance. So we need phosphorus to lift the calcium away from the earth. So there's an activity in the oak that lifts the calcium pole into the phosphorus pole, moves it from the center to the periphery. So what do we use? We use the bark of the oak tree. Why not the wood? Because the bark is the periphery. So the oak has a dynamic where it lifts the calcium into the periphery, and then we take that substance that is a representative of the dynamic from the center to the periphery. And what do? We put it in a container. And the container is made of is a bone. And bone is calcium phosphate. And not only is it just calcium phosphate, but it's in a form where I have a membrane of calcium phosphate on the periphery of a very active organ in an animal. And in the calcium phosphate that's in the skull, if you looked at a cross section of the bone, you would see these little like fingers, little dendrites that go, and that's the activity of silica making beautiful like bridge trusses there so that the bone is light but very strong. That silica builds these trusses as the calcium is mobilized by the phosphorus. So we get this calcium phosphate, beautiful like castle in the skull. And we put the substance coming from the plant, in which this plant has a very dynamic movement of calcium into the phosphorus pole. And we put the two of them together and we get synergy. We get a harmony between two different levels of energy in a particular system, from the plant to the animal. And then we take that in the winter, which is a kind of peripheral time. I know it sounds kind of funny, but the winter is the time when the peripheral forces work the most. That's what frost is. The water is showing a kind of silica gesture when the frost comes. So during the winter, the earth is most open to the periphery. I put this beautiful little castle of calcium phosphate with the calcium phosphorus substance in the water during the winter so that the forces from the periphery act on it. And then I take that substance out and that becomes a prophylactic later when I put that in the compost heap so that plants have a sense of what the relationship between the center and the periphery is. It gives them a sense that even though they may be in the water, they can still hold the line. That's the role of calcium in nature's kingdom, is to make integrity in the cell wall of a plant or an animal, calcium. So in that prep, Rudolf Steiner has beautifully brought together a plant organ of a dynamic and an animal organ of the same dynamic and put them together in a time frame where that dynamic is most active. So we have a principle that we could call synergy, which is I bring two things together that have a similar gesture, I get enhancement. And then syzygy, S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y, which means I have to take advantage of a particular time frame. Syzygy is a technical term in astronomy, meaning that a certain group of planets come together in a particular configuration for a very short period of time. So when I can get synergy and syzygy and they come together, I get an enhancement of the forces that I'm trying to steer in a particular way. The substance, if you were to analyze it, would be probably the same, chemically the same thing. But a seashell and your tooth and a piece of marble are chemically the same thing. But, okay, so there's a formative principle that when the calcium is led by the phosphorus in the context of silica, there's a formative principle that gives a picture of the cell. That skull is a picture of a cell of a plant. You have the soft stuff on the inside and the cell wall on the outside. So it gives a kind of dynamic to the substance that then can be transferred because it's been enhanced through synergy and syzygy to be used in the heap so that the plant understands this relationship between the forces of the center and the forces of the periphery. It's a prophylactic against fungal invasion. Yeah? So when we speak that way, hopefully you can see that these pictures from chemistry and biology and botany and whatever and then astronomy, they are all harmonious. It's just the incredible brilliance of Rudolf Steiner to be able to see them and say, you know, just take some oak bark and put it in a skull and put it in the water in the winter. And we go, okay, I'll do that, all right. But then when, unless we can actually give good pictures, then we say, well, I don't know why this works, I just do it. And then somebody who is uninformed about it takes that and puts it into a bad context, and then we've got difficulties. I don't know, I just do it. Well, that sounds a little strange to me. Why are you doing this? Yeah. Well, some guy who, I don't know why he said it, but he said, do this, and we're doing it. Oh, really? Is this a new religion? You see where it goes. Okay. So my plea is that through the day now, I'm going to try to take the preps and say, there is actually logic behind this. But in my class in Sacramento, we have a new saying, logic is for beginners. So you need the logic, but at a certain point, the logic has to be transcended into poetry. But the poetry has to be as precise as the logic. Okay, so in the oak bark, we have a picture of then phosphorus moving the calcium into an activity. So if we go to the right now and we look at that little diagram, I have the salt pole on the left. I have potassium and calcium under the salt pole. The problem in the natural world, especially with fertilizers and plants, is not the substance, but the uptake of the substance, the assimilation of the substance. So among the substances, there are certain substances which are what are called available. And there are other substances that are not available, that have to be moved, so to speak. And up on the board here, on the right, I have the primary substances, NPK. It just so happens that NPK are the substances in nature that are available. So because they're available, the plants can take them up. And because the plants can take them up, they use them, and we can, when we put them on a plant, we see the plant take it up, and we go, oh, this seems to be really good. But it just turns out that the secondary substances of calcium, sulfur, and magnesium are not as available. They need to be activated. So they need some type of catalyst. They need some type of agent to get them to move and transform. Their role in nature is to regulate rampant uptake. They they're regulators. The magnesium regulates the way in which the light activates chlorophyll. The sulfur regulates the way phosphorus, plants can gorge on phosphorus. They can just take it up and run because phosphorus is the thing that triggers enzyme reaction. It's called phosphorylation. So when a plant needs energy, it has to uptake phosphorus and get the phosphorus in relationship to protein structures, and that creates adenine triphosphate and energy release, and all the chemistry has to do with phosphorus, the light bearer, the one that creates the energy, the one that allows the plant to just keep going. But if there's a lot of phosphorus, the plant just keeps growing and growing and growing. We get hypertrophy. Yeah, so we don't want that. So there are agents which hold that back. The agent which holds that back is sulfur. Sulfur is in the sulfur pole. So here I have phosphorus and sulfur in the sulfur pole. Sulfur pole is the pole in which the plant moves towards flowering. But the plant moving towards flowering is destroying itself. It's burning. It's combusting. So the plant that's moving towards flowering is checking out. It's no longer vegetating. It's no longer incarnating. It's excarnating. An alchemist would call that sulfur. Sulfur moves plants towards a seeding process. That's why it's so effective with funguses, because funguses love the vegetative mode because that's where all the rot is. That's their mode, earth and water. So I bring a little sulfur in, and the sulfur says, wait a minute, let's just hold back on this enzymatic stuff you're doing. Because these mycology is enzyme. Protease and breakdown, and let's penetrate this thing and break this membrane down and move this. Yeah. That's kind of the specialty of these lower plants. So let's just dissolve everything. Let's just destroy it. So I bring a little sulfur in, and the sulfur says, "Oh, wait a minute. Let's just hold back on this a little bit." So this action of this, what we could call the sulfur pull, sulfur involves air and fire, phosphorus, light, warmth. And there are two brands of sulfur. One is the regulating sulfur of sulfur, and one is the kind of run it on out and get the energy moving and just keep transforming. That's the phosphorus. So in the language of alchemy, the sulfur, the substance sulfur in the sulfur pole, maybe I'll just call the sulfur pole sulf to make the difference. The sulf pole has a kind of held back earth sulf, that's sulfur as a substance, and a go ahead, gun the engine sulfur, that's phosphorus, as far as uptake. Because if there was just phosphorus, the plants would just go bananas. If there was just sulfur, then the plant growth would be very limited. And it would be difficult to move it to flowering if it was just sulfur. There'd be a kind of burning and ash forming because the sulfur, when it acts in the plant, once the sulfur is in a plant, it just gets locked in the leaf and then the sulfur gets moved to the new growing area. The phosphorus circulates just freely within the plant at all times. So these are two kind of poles. One is a little centric. So in the sulf pole, sulfur is the centric one. It's the one that kind of puts the brakes on rampant growth. But the phosphorus is the one that just stimulates uptake and assimilation. Okay, so we have in the sulf pole these two polarities, even within these kind of fiery, warm, airy substances, the phosphorus and the sulfur. Is it okay, the language? I hope it's, yeah? So we could say the sulfur is the warm sulf, and the phosphorus is the cool, kind of cosmic sulf. This sulfur is a regulating sulf, and phosphorus is a stimulating, assimilating sulf. And if you look in the chemistry of plants and protein and assimilation, you'll see these pictures. But you won't hear them in the context of these polarities. It'll just be said, the sulfur gets activated by nitrogen. It's selectively mobile. So there's a kind of push and pull between and when the sulfur is active in a plant. The more nitrogen, then sulfur becomes active. Sulfur moves the plant towards the production of the seed. It hastens that, but it kind of holds when there's nitrogen. When there's no nitrogen, then it holds. So nitrogen here, if you look up nitrogen as a primer, it has a yellow circle around it. The yellow is the mercury. So on the polarities over here, I have center, periphery, and then I have a yellow slash. I have inner planets, outer planets, yellow slash, calcium silica, yellow slash. The yellow is a code word, mercury. Mercury is the force that keeps the polarities interacting. And the code word for mercury is rhythm. Mercury means rhythm. So the nitrogen in NPK is the mercury. And NPK itself is a kind of sulf, gesture. It's the mobile gesture. It's the assimilation gesture, NPK. Okay, so now we did the sulfur. So let's go over to the salt. The salt. There are two substances in the salt pole. One is potassium, the other is calcium. They're both nutritive salts. Potassium is the K in NPK. And calcium, and it's a primary active assimilating, easily assimilable, very mobile substance. It builds ion channels in leaves that allow for energy exchange in the metabolism of plants. That's its function according to chemistry. Potassium. It's very mobile. Calcium, and you would find that like in the substance of a cell. The calcium you would find in the cell wall. It's like, you can think like bricks. The calcium wants to fix. The potassium wants to build channels in the wall to make things move. So potassium uptake is very labile, very open and mobile. And the calcium uptake is very, very slow. It kind of puts the brakes on things and says, here, just fix this. So we have in the salt pole, then these same two polarities, the one that's mobile and the one that's not. We have a mobile salt and a fixed kind of salt. We have a mobile fire or sulfur and a kind of fixed or selectively mobile sulfur. Okay, so hopefully this we get a little more sense out of when we say NPK. It actually is organized in such a way with these polarities with center and periphery, and in the alchemical language we can begin to understand then what the chemistry of a plant is doing from the point of view of the dynamic of the substances. Okay, so calcium as a substance has a tendency to be fixed. It needs to have phosphorus move it. Without it, you get a kind of stunted growth, kind of fixed, chalky nature. But in the context of phosphorus, the calcium becomes mobilized, and the calcium can be moved from one part to another in a plant and builds the integrity of the cell wall. That's its function. The phosphorus moves it to the periphery. The sulfur has a difficult time moving the calcium unless there's enough nitrogen. Then the nitrogen activates the sulfur. The sulfur can help move the calcium. Yeah, there's just, you know, if you looked at a plant chemistry book, you would see this stuff. But hopefully, in the context I'm trying to present it, we see that these are polarities of the dynamic of the substances. So in biodynamics, we need to have a sense of what is the fixed pole, what is the earth pole, what is the centric pole, and what is the mobile pole, what is the ABC, XYZ of plant growth. The mobility, the assimilation, is from the periphery, the forces of the periphery. The fixedness is from the forces of the earth. The earth represents a kind of solidification and a deposition, deposit. That's, in the language of alchemy, that's called salt. So if I have a solution of salt, there is a levity force where the salt crystal dissolves into the water. The levity force when I have a salt solution is the activity of the forces of the periphery. My crystal goes away into a levity state. the difficult part about modern science is they are dealing with levity all the time, but they're not allowed to say that it's levity. It's because that's woo-woo. Levity. What do you mean, levity? But it actually is a kind of counterforce to the, but it's, we can't measure it. But we begin to measure it in 5 parts per million. Think about that as a substance. What kind of substance is that? 5 parts per million. I take a million drops minus 5 of wine and I put 5 drops of water. Or a million drops of water and 5 drops of wine. That's 5 parts per million. So is that a substance, the wine? You and I would say no. But it can be measured. So that when things get, that's called attenuation. So when things get attenuated, when they get spread out, they start to come in the contact of the forces of the periphery, and other forces are active. This is where enzymes get their activity from, these parts per million type of stuff. I read an interesting article, a guy wrote about plant pigments. And there's this Phodopsin or something, I can't exactly remember what the name of the pigment was, that it is the substance in a plant that receives the sunlight that stimulates the process of phosphorylation, of where phosphorus starts to create enzyme cascades as it's going. This enzyme opens, that creates the way in which the plants digest and metabolize and create oils and sugars and whatever. It's all enzymes. These are the finest substances, or almost not even substances. That's, Rudolf Steiner would say, that's levity. When we get into parts per million and stuff we can hardly even measure, that's levity. It's just another realm. And it's where the substances that get so finely attenuated, they almost don't even exist anymore. That's the boundary. That's where the life comes in. Sunlight. What is that? Is it a substance that's in the plant? Where's it come from? Periphery. What do you mean, periphery? This is the realm of what we could call the dynamic in nature. Always it's on the edge where the dynamic moves to a place where there is a reaction that starts to cascade towards the center, and then the center picks it up and says, oh, I see, we're having a cascade here. And then they meet, and the cascade is a rhythm. That's Mercury. There's this one, and then there's this one. And then this one, the protease, and the, eights and azes, and all of that, all of the way in which they speak to each other. That's the rhythm. That's what an alchemist would call Mercury. An activity, and that changes through the year. Changes with what? With the sunlight, with the photo period. Well, what is that? That's again, that's a rhythm. That's a Mercury. And does the photo period come from the center, from the earth? No, it comes from the periphery, and it does flowering and fruiting and all this kind of stuff happens, and migration of animals and reproductive cycles in animals, all is triggered from the periphery. From what? Light. Just light? Well, no, light and dark. Well, just light and dark light? No, well, kind of, you know, rhythm of light and dark. It kind of changes things. We call it seasons. But it really is the action of the periphery. Of these very, very fine forces that can hardly be measured. We can measure day and night, but the actual agent of what the day and night is doing, it's really hard to measure. We now have a pigment we can measure that picks up light and starts the phosphorus activity. And we can find the pigment, but then why this pigment? What is that? What is phosphorus? Phosphorus actually doesn't exist it exists as a phosphate rock, but as a phosphate rock, it's unavailable. We have to do something. If you want to get phosphorus today, you take a bunch of phosphate rocks, you heat them, the phosphorus comes out and forms an exudate, and you scrape that off, and that's phosphorus. It exists in nature just in interactions, unless it's locked to calcium, then it becomes a phosphate rock or a bone. So in the bone, the phosphorus has died trying to resurrect calcium. So in a bone, calcium has gone through a death process because the phosphorus doesn't have the force to lift it anymore. So I add a little nitrogen so the sulfur can help the calcium to move. And the calcium gets moving, the phosphorus can pick it up, and the potassium forms the channels so that it can move in a particular direction. Potassium says, follow me. Then we call it fertilizing or chemistry. Okay, but it's a language, and we can make a bridge between that language and the language of alchemy through the idea of polarity. So what I want to do now when we come back is go through the dandelion prep and the yarrow and those preps and look at how calcium and phosphorus and potassium and sulfur are integrated and organized in the particular prep, and see if we can see how that is integrated into the organism of an animal, and then picture of the planetary movements connected to that.